This is CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph. Listening to CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph. And now, a BBC World Service update.
The news.
BBC News with Jonathan Izard. 9 Palestinian militants have been killed in Israeli airstrikes on the Gaza Strip. Tension has been high since the murder of the Palestinian teenager Mohammed Abu Qadir. Hamas accused Israel of escalating the current situation. Kevin Connolly reports.
Last week ended with speculation that some kind of ceasefire between Hamas and Israel may have been imminent. Any such prospect now seems remote after a weekend of intense rocket fire from Gaza and a series of overnight airstrikes from Israel. In the most serious of those strikes, it's now reported that 6 Hamas fighters were killed after the Israeli Air Force targeted what the militant group called a gathering point at the southern end of the Gaza Strip. A 7th Hamas member died in a separate strike, and 2 other militants were killed in a third. Angry crowds gathered at the hospital to which the bodies were taken, and a Hamas spokesman warned that Israel would, in his words, pay a price for what he described as an escalation.
The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said he will not allow extremists from any side to inflame the region and cause more bloodshed. He was speaking after Israeli police had arrested 6 Jewish suspects in connection with Mohammed Abu Qadir's death. Security has been tightened in the Iraqi capital Baghdad amid fears that the jihadist group ISIS is planning a bombing campaign there. At least 4 people were killed late on Sunday when a suicide bomber attacked a cafe in a Shia neighbourhood. Australia has acknowledged that it's returned 41 asylum seekers to the Sri Lankan authorities at sea. The comments follow concerns that more than 200 Sri Lankans may have been handed over earlier, many of them Tamils who say they face persecution at home. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The Immigration Minister, Scott Morrison, says Australia thoroughly assessed the passengers' refugee claims before they were handed over to the Sri Lankan Navy. Rights groups, however, believe that Canberra is violating international law and that the lives of those fleeing persecution could be in danger. Following an election last year, the Conservative government promised to stem a steady flow of unauthorised arrivals coming by sea. It reopened offshore detention camps in the South Pacific as a deterrent.
The Pakistani politician Imran Khan has said the army should allow aid agencies to help the people displaced by the military operation against the Taliban in the northwest. He told the BBC that without their assistance, his party's government in the region would not be able to cope.
This is going to be a huge human tragedy unless we allow international NGOs to come in, because there are 350,000 children, as you see this. So, I mean, it's beyond the capacity, although we're going to now ask volunteers to join us here, but we still need professionals who are trained to deal with emergencies like the international NGOs.
Officials say up to 750,000 people have left their homes since the operation started 3 weeks ago. The aim of the campaign is to drive the insurgents from their safe havens in North Waziristan. World News from the BBC. The Ukrainian government says it will continue its operation against the rebels in the east of the country after retaking a series of towns over the weekend. On Sunday, Artyomovsk and Rushkivka fell into government hands, and on Saturday, the militants abandoned their stronghold Slovyansk. The insurgents have moved to other locations, mainly the regional capital Donetsk, where their leaders told a rally attended by a few thousand supporters that they would continue the fight from there. The German Chancellor Angela Merkel has labelled as serious allegations that a German man worked as a double agent for the United States. She said that if these allegations were true, it would constitute a serious breach of trust. They were her first comments on the arrest last week of a German employee of the country's Foreign Intelligence Service. Prosecutors say the man handed over more than 200 documents over a 2-year period. Pope Francis will meet victims of sexual abuse by Roman Catholic priests on Monday. It'll be the first such meeting since the Pope was elected 16 months ago. Pope Francis has said he will not tolerate sexual abuse by priests and has said dealing with it is vital for the Church's credibility. David Willey reports from Rome.
The scandal caused by revelations during the past decade of widespread sexual abuse of children by Catholic priests in many countries, often dating back many years, has damaged the Church's credibility. Pope Francis has now set up a committee of experts, men and women, including psychiatrists, clerics, and one victim, Mari Collins from Ireland, to draw up plans to deal with predator priests.
Cambridge University has for the first time made available to the public files smuggled out of Russia by a KGB official in 1992. The papers are considered to be the most important single intelligence source obtained by the West. The documents outline Soviet tactics, give details of weapons caches, and reveal undercover agents, the US spy Robert Lipka and Briton Melita Norwood. BBC News.
Thanks to Jonathan. Hello and welcome to Newsday. Shaima and Lawrence with you.
The picture of the mass funeral for 16-year-old Mohammed Boukhtir is on the front page of the Haaretz newspaper website, and a headline in the Jerusalem Post says Hamas says the Israeli Air Force airstrike kills 7 militants in Gaza.
We'll have more on that story as tensions in the region remain high following the murder of Mohammed Boukhtir and the beating of his cousin, American citizen Tariq Boukhtir, by Israeli police, or at least that's what a video seems to show. All that coming up along with the business and the sport as well in this half hour of Newsday from the BBC World Service.
Now, there's been talk about a unity government, but really, there is no sign of it. That's in Iraq, and a place, and Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki appears to be clinging onto power despite international calls for him to go. Meanwhile, reports from Baghdad suggest Sunni fighters are on the outskirts of the capital. Laith Qubba is former spokesman for the Iraqi government.
What ISIS is doing is a phenomenon now that has left behind the politics in Baghdad by a long, long way. ISIS has declared Khilafah.
It's the Islamic State.
Right. It's the Islamic State, and declaring in particular Khilafah, which is like a legal religious term of an Islamic rule that has not been in place for 100 years. And a lot of people believe if this is declared anywhere, then people have an obligation to support it. That is the reason ISIS today has emerged to become extremely powerful, threatening to Saudi Arabia, to Jordan, let alone Iraq.
Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi has come out with a strong message to address the many Muslims that he says he's now heading as their Khalifa, as their head of state. How effective do you think Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi's message is?
It's extremely effective. This is a combination of, let's say, the people who came out of the political Islam experience where no violence is used, and people who came out of Al-Qaeda experience where only violence was used. This is a new breed. They captured territory. They declared Khilafah. This is going to bring them thousands and thousands of volunteers.
But by the same token, there are people who say that these people, ISIS, do not represent Islam. They do not represent us as Muslims.
Out of the 1,000 million Muslims, I think if Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi can get only 10 or 20,000, he did well. If there are just some angry young people out there, scattered in numbers, minority of a minority, still, if he captures them and he has territory and he has know-how and he has cities and he can play politics with local frustration, with people who are angry with Maliki, with people who are angry in the Arab world, that gives him a lot of leverage.
One of the terms that was being used when ISIS gained territory in Iraq was civil war. Our Middle East editor has been speaking to leaders and fighters of Asaib Ahlul Haq, the League of the Righteous, which is a mainly Shia militant group, very, very powerful. And they've been speaking about being ready to fight ISIS. How would you describe that situation? Is it fair then to call it civil war?
Well, I think both militia groups have totally different agendas. But the real fear is that this theater of wars and battle and contesting agendas is happening in a country where there are 30 million people urbanized, and their towns and cities have become theater of these wars. We're all very, very concerned that there aren't any checks and balances on how this war is escalating. And it's the innocent population. They are the first victim.
Laith Qubba there, former spokesman for the Iraqi government.
And stay tuned a little bit later on this programme. You'll hear a report from Jeremy Byrne, our Middle East editor, inside the main Shia militia, the League of the Righteous, who are taking the fight to ISIS. Well worth listening out for. It's coming up to 11 minutes past the hour. Now let's go to Ukraine. Two more cities in the east have been retaken by government military forces. This follows the strategically important recapture of the city of Slovyansk from those Russian separatist rebels in the east. The retaking of Artyomivsk and Rushkiva adds to the symbolic momentum that Ukrainian forces have apparently mustered in recent days.
But rebel fighters are reported to have regrouped elsewhere and have made an attack on the state prison in Donetsk, another rebel stronghold, in a bid to acquire weaponry.
Let's get an assessment of the latest events from Oleg Rybachuk, a former member of the Ukrainian parliament, then chief of staff to the former president, Viktor Yushchenko. Oleg, welcome back to the programme. First off, just give us an idea. A series of quite striking victories for the government, which the government has been waiting for a long time. What has changed? Why are the military making gains now?
Well, yeah, good morning. It's really very important what has happened lately, because after ceasefire, which was violated by rebels hundreds of times, a government is very determined to show that it is ready to deal with those who don't want to surrender. The fact that they liberated Slovyansk is extremely politically important, because from the rebels' propaganda point of view, Slovyansk was a capital, a stronghold, a symbol of this so-called newly republics. What happens today? You are right. There are big casualties suffered by rebels, but most important, they are on the run. Psychologically, they are losing. Whatever they would like to say, it's very unconvincing, and they are now moved into Donetsk. But they don't feel safe there as well. They are not welcomed. They are not no more presenting themselves as defenders of people, which was actually the reason they moved into the country. Many of them are coming from Russia. There is no chance for them now to be liberated by Russian regular troops. So, in short, that situation has significantly improved from
that was a point, Oleg, I wanted to pick up on. It's crucially important that Russia hasn't come to help and come to the assistance of the pro-Russian rebels. There were even quotes over the weekend of various of the rebel leaders saying, in effect, that they'd been abandoned. Do you think that is now off the table, that there is no danger of a formal Russian involvement in eastern Ukraine now?
Yeah, I mean, open regular army invasion, I think, is out of question for a number of reasons. I think Mr. Putin perfectly realized that the world is ready to act in this case, and the casualties he would suffer politically and economically are incomparable to the gains. Moreover, well, we are a big country. You can't actually invade 45 million worth country, and the army is now much stronger. There are big number of volunteers. Army started acting much more coordinated, effectively, and rebels are not getting support from the citizens.
But Oleg, sorry to interrupt, doesn't this also depend what happens in Donetsk? I mean, the idea of street-by-street fighting against committed and well-armed insurgents is a pretty horrific idea. If there are civilian casualties, for example, incurred in the government's operation to take back Donetsk, that changes the situation, doesn't it? How can that be avoided?
No, it doesn't look like that would be, the real fight going on in Donetsk, street by street, house by house, because the very reason of that rebellion, of that Russian volunteers and special operations troops moving into the part of the country was to make it part of Russia, as it happened in Crimea. So Donetsk is a 1 million, more than 1 million populated city. Yesterday, rebels tried to organize a rally in their support. Less than 1,000 people appeared to. So it would be not so easy for them to survive there. I don't know how my government is going to act, but clearly it won't be a regular operations. I think that lots of rebels would simply surrender after the border is sealed and they would understand that there is no perspective.
Yeah. You're looking ahead to a military victory. In that case, if that does happen, you still have to undo the damage, as it were. You have to win hearts and minds again. Is that a battle that you can win?
Yeah, it's easier, sir, to do that because number of myths are just evaporating. The rebels came there to protect local residents versus vicious fascists, junta, as they said, coming from Kiev. Now liberated citizens are welcoming actually army because they are getting food supply, they are getting emergencies, they are getting normal life back, like water supply, energy supply. So it will not be easy for rebels to present anymore and to try to use Ukrainian central government as crazy killers.
Right. Listen, many, many thanks indeed. That job will begin soon, I'm sure. Oleg Rybachuk, many, many thanks indeed for joining us. Former member of the Ukrainian Parliament, looking ahead to what the Ukrainian government has to do to re-establish its control of the rebel areas. Oleg was also chief of staff to the former president, Viktor Yushchenko. Many thanks to him.
Let's get some sports headlines now with Kirsten Webster.
Yeah, Nigeria have a day to change their mind and reinstate the leadership of their National Football Federation or face expulsion from international competitions. FIFA are threatening to throw them out after what they deem as political interference in the country's football affairs. That one will develop over the day, I'm sure. Despite losing the Wimbledon final to Novak Djokovic, Roger Federer is still hungry for more success in tennis. At 32 years old, he was questioned after the defeat whether he had more major titles in him. And he says he hopes to use the last 2 weeks as a stepping stone to more success. At 32 years old, he, according to Tony, in the last hour, he's about 18 years off his peak, so he can still keep going. Yeah. And cycling's Tour de France heads to London today. 2.5 million people lined the roads of Yorkshire over the weekend. The tour director of the Tour de France actually thinks it was more like 5 million people that lined the roads, and he says it was the grandest Grand Depart ever.
There you go.
Hey, oh. That was great.
I don't think the rules of pay apply strictly to Roger Federer. I think he's broken that record.
Is he only 32?
He's only 32. Yeah.
That's amazing because he's been around at the top for so long. I honestly thought he was an old croc.
And because he lost in the final, people are saying, well, is it time to retire? Blah, blah, blah. You can't win a Grand Slam. He got to the final of Wimbledon. Mm. Yeah.
He's pretty good.
It actually pained me when he lost yesterday. I'm a massive Federer fan.
More editorial.
Your friend Djokovic won.
Yeah, I like Djokovic too, but I did have tears in my eyes for Federer.
More from Kirsten and her tears in about 20 minutes' time.
Now, we've been telling you about this. How do you determine the price of gold? Well, banks will be hoping to hit off another potential scandal later today. They are meeting to discuss changes to the way the price of gold is calculated. So, well, Tony Bonsignore is here. He's going to tell us all about it. How is the gold price set? And why are we saying that this is controversial? Why are we saying they're setting off to avoid another potential scandal?
Okay, so, well, given how much technology is in markets, you would think perhaps that there's big computers calculating the price of gold, and you can press a button at any moment and it'll give you a latest price. I'll tell you what happens is every twice a day, 10:30 in the morning, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, four banks get together on a telephone conference call, which nobody else can hear. They discuss with each other what sort of price they might buy and sell at, and they decide between themselves with no record what the price of gold is. It's called the gold fix. It's pretty much exactly the same as it was when this thing was invented in 1919.
But what? Without the telephones.
Without the telephone. That's about the only thing that's changed. So this is controversial because critics say there's all sorts of abuse that could happen in that. You could manipulate the price. So today there's a big meeting where experts are going to come together and going to say, look, is there a way we need to change this, make it more transparent so there's less chance of another scandal?
So they've been doing this the same way for such a long time. Why have they been left to their ways to do it that way?
Yeah. very good question, because to an extent it's the way things have always been done.
Yeah.
It was done in the silver market. People have complained, but things tend to not change until something goes wrong. And something's gone wrong here because a trader at Barclays was found to have manipulated the gold price about 2 months ago. And since that, they got fined £26 million. Since that, funnily enough, it's become a big issue, especially when you look at things like LIBOR as well. The banks are under the spotlight.
So they're having a big meeting today. Does that mean that the way that the gold will be priced is going to be different? There's going to be a different system where they're just talking about how things are going.
I don't think we'll get definite answers today, but I think they're moving in that direction. The gold industry and the banks are fearful because they're looking at this and thinking, is there a chance of another scandal? And we've seen what happened with LIBOR. We've got foreign exchange at the moment. We've got everything that's happened over the past 10 years. The banks are desperate to avoid another scandal like that. So I feel they need to do something.
So they need to be looking like they're doing something at the moment.
Yeah, and I think they will eventually have to do something. What it's going to be replaced with, that remains to be seen.
Tony, many thanks. Tony Bonsignore.
Fascinating. 21 minutes past the hour. This is Newsday. Now to Australia. A story that we were covering at the end of last week when it wasn't quite clear what had happened on the high seas, the Indian Ocean. The Australian government has now confirmed that it returned 41 asylum seekers to the Sri Lankan authorities, transferring them at sea. Now, usually the idea is that people are taken to processing centres when the asylum boats are picked up and they're interviewed and they're dealt with on an individual basis. The confirmation of what actually happened comes after days of speculation about what had actually happened to the asylum seekers. At some stage, no one knew where they were. The UN is expressing concern. Refugee campaigners say it's a disgraceful violation of international law. Let's get more from our correspondent in Sydney, Phil Mercer. Those are some of the issues. Why has it finally come out now? Did the government was the government embarrassed into making a statement because there was so much controversy about this?
What we have is a government that is employing an official policy of silence. It says that it won't comment on what it says are operational reasons. And now we've seen the operation at sea completed. And that's why we now have official word from the authorities in Canberra. What they're telling us is that 41 asylum seekers were intercepted on a boat near the Cocos Islands. This is a remote Australian territory in the Indian Ocean, roughly halfway between Australia and Sri Lanka. And we've had today first official comment that this boat in fact exists. The Immigration Minister Scott Morrison says that most of those on board, the vast majority of the passengers, had their asylum applications dealt with on the high seas. They were rejected and now they are in the care of the Sri Lankan Navy.
Now, we said refugee campaigners are obviously outraged about this, but politically, is this a popular move in Australia, bearing in mind the tone of the debate over immigration generally?
Well, it's difficult to say because last September, the Conservative Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, before September, he was the opposition leader, and he promised going into that election that he would get tough on a steady stream of unauthorised arrivals coming to Australia by sea. He said, in his words, Mr. Abbott, that he would stop the boats. The military was called in to fortify Australia's northern maritime borders, offshore processing camps in Papua New Guinea and on the tiny Pacific island of Nauru were reopened, and Mr. Abbott won a landslide election. So perhaps there were many Australians who thought that that was a good idea. On the other side of the equation, you have critics who say Australia is breaking international law, it's violating the human rights of these asylum seekers. They say that Australia is a rich, prosperous country that should and could be doing far more to help vulnerable people.
And give us an idea, Phil, practically, what happens next? The concerns, obviously, have been raised about the fate of these people when they go back to Sri Lanka, if they're going to be reasonably treated. Can the Australian government give any guarantees or any information as far as that's concerned?
Well, the Prime Minister, Mr. Abbott, said that he was confident that these asylum seekers were in safe hands. He's insisted that Sri Lanka is a safe place for asylum seekers to be returned too. Refugee advocates have a very different view. They say that Tamils especially who've left Sri Lanka may be at risk of persecution or worse if they're returned home. So this is a very, very thorny and divisive political issue. As far as Australia is concerned, it's now washed its hands of those 41 asylum seekers who've been transferred on the high seas to Sri Lankan authorities.
Many, many thanks indeed. From Sydney, with all the background to that story, Phil Mercer.
You're listening to Newsday from the BBC World Service. Israeli police have arrested six Jewish suspects in connection with the abduction and murder of a Palestinian teenager in East Jerusalem last week. That killing followed the kidnap and murder of three Israeli teenagers. And Israeli security sources believe that latest killing may have been a revenge attack.
Now, Israel's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, has issued a statement denouncing Jewish extremism as terrorism. Here's the lawyer of one of the Jewish suspects.
There is a warrant against us meeting our clients, so we don't know what exactly are the accusations they heard, what were their reactions, and even though we do know several things, we cannot tell them because nothing is being allowed to be published because of the warrant. So in this stage we'll have to wait. We will appeal to the higher court against the warrant that prevents us from meeting them, and I hope we'll get good results tomorrow.
That's lawyer Benzion Kveller. So what details are known about these six individuals? Well, Gil Hoffman is the chief political correspondent for the Jerusalem Post.
So there's a lot of information that's under a gag order right now. But what we do know is that they don't have criminal records. They had not been followed by the Israeli security agencies whose job it is to follow extremists. And some of them are ultra-Orthodox, at least, and some of them are below the age of 18. They're going to be prosecuted to the fullest. The police have said that they have very serious evidence against them. They have a very strong case, and this is a country that can boast a legal system that puts such people behind bars for a very long time.
Well, the Jerusalem Post on their website this morning is saying that one of the six Israelis arrested has admitted his guilt, although obviously there's no confirmation of that at all. Meanwhile, in another twist, the cousin of the murdered Palestinian boy is an American teenager who's been visiting his Palestinian family in Jerusalem, and mobile phone footage has emerged appearing to show two Israeli policemen punching him in the head. The police say the boy was taking part in violence. This is what Tariq Khadir, which is the boy's name, told reporters after he was released, rather bruised in the face, from custody.
Yeah, the summer vacation turned out to be a summer vacation that I needed to fight for my cousin. That's it.
What do you want to say to the Israeli public who sees you right now?
I'm speechless. I don't know what to say to them.
Do you have any message?
No, I don't.
Is there any hope?
Tariq, how do you explain this to the Americans when you go home?
I was brutally attacked when I was just watching what was happening. That's it.
So that's Tariq Khadir, the cousin of Muhammad Khadir, the Palestinian teenager who was killed. He was talking to reporters after he was released from custody. Now, the BBC's James Reynolds in Jerusalem was outside the court with other journalists when Tariq was released and talked to him.
He looked pretty shaken, and his face was still very, very swollen as he left. But he told the group of reporters, and I was there outside the court, that he'd simply been watching the protests on Thursday, a day after his cousin Mohammed's death, when he said he heard or sensed people coming from one side of him. They then started hitting him. He believed they were policemen. He said he was screaming, and then he used a very distinctive phrase. He said, "I fell asleep." I think that's his way of saying he was knocked out. And then he says his next memory was waking up in hospital. He said he'd been well treated in his few days in custody and was obviously off with his family to spend the next few days under house arrest. And I stood perhaps at one point 50 centimetres away from him, almost able to touch him, and his face was still very, very swollen.
BBC's James Reynolds there outside the court, as you say, very, very close to Tariq Khadir, who was released after he was held in custody after being beaten heavily.
Newsday from the BBC World Service, Lawrence Scheimer, and the news along in a minute's time.
With bbc.com/news, you get the latest news stories anytime you like. bbc.com/news offers you the most comprehensive news coverage in the world, and its stories are easy to search and navigate. Whether you're interested in science, health, technology or business, the bbc.com/news website can offer it all. It also gives you the opportunity to listen live to our news output or check the latest breaking news with our minute-by-minute news feed. If you want to take the news with you, we offer you downloadable podcasts to listen at your convenience, or archive programming so you can catch up on the programmes you've missed. Or you can access bbc.com/news on your mobile phone. bbc.com/news also lets you give feedback direct to our programme teams. All this content, coverage and opportunity makes the BBC the world leader in news coverage online.
Hello and welcome. This is Newsday from the BBC World Service with Shaima Khalil and Lawrence Pollard. In Iraq, our Middle East editor gets exclusive access to a major Shia militia, the League of the Righteous. We'll hear from him.
Also, how Australia processes asylum seekers. Away from scrutiny on the high seas, it's proving very controversial in the case of 41 Sri Lankans. We'll find out more. And the latest on the Pistorius case after a video airs in Australia that shouldn't.
BBC News with Jonathan Izard. Nine Palestinian militants have been killed in Israeli airstrikes on the Gaza Strip. The militant group Hamas said six of its fighters died in an attack in the south of the coastal strip. In a rare direct message to the group, the Israeli military said it wanted to avoid a further escalation, but extra troops have been deployed near the border. The Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, has said he will not allow extremists from any side to inflame the region and cause more bloodshed. He was speaking after Israeli police had arrested six Jewish suspects in connection with the abduction and murder of Palestinian teenager Mohammed Abdelkader last week. Australia has acknowledged that it's handed over 41 asylum seekers to the Sri Lankan authorities at sea. The comments follow concerns that more than 200 Sri Lankans may have been handed over earlier, many of them Tamils who say they face persecution. Security has been tightened in the Iraqi capital Baghdad amid fears that the jihadist group ISIS is planning a bombing campaign there. At least four people were killed late on Sunday when a suicide bomber attacked a cafe in a Shia neighbourhood of the city. The Ukrainian government says it will continue its operation against the rebels in the east of the country after retaking a series of towns over the weekend. On Sunday, Artyomovsk and Druzhkivka fell into government hands, and on Saturday the militants abandoned their stronghold, Slovyansk. The German Chancellor Angela Merkel is today holding talks with the Chinese leadership in Beijing. The focus of the visit, her seventh to the country, has been on economic ties. Last year, Germany exported more than $90 billion worth of goods to China. Pope Francis is today due to meet victims of sexual abuse by Roman Catholic priests. It'll be the first such meeting since his election 16 months ago. The Pope has set up a panel to consider how to deal with offending priests and to offer protection to victims, but he has been criticised for not meeting victims sooner. That's the latest. We'll have a full bulletin for you at the top of the hour of BBC News.
Many thanks to Jonathan. Hello and welcome to Newsday with Shaima Khalil and Lawrence Pollard. We'll cross over to Iraq. Asaib al-Haq, or the League of the Righteous, is a major Shia militia fighting alongside the government forces. Our Middle East editor, Jeremy Bowen, has been speaking to them about their fight against ISIS.
Also, urgent calls for a full-scale inquiry into allegations of child abuse by politicians in Britain in the early 1980s. We'll be speaking live to the Member of Parliament who has raised the issue.